Recyclical, making lithium ion last forever. Recyclical's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclical Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB AMYZF, and Frankfurt ID4. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever.
You're listening to HowStreet.com Radio, available online at talkdigitalnetwork.com. Welcome to HowStreet.com Radio, the online source for market opinions. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is Danielle Park, editor of the popular blog Juggling Dynamite and president of Venable Park Investment Council Incorporated. Her websites, jugglingdynamite.com and venablepark.com. Welcome back to the show, Danielle.
Thank you, Jim.
Danielle, will the Fed actually cut rates this year? They seem to be pulling back every time somebody talks to them.
Yeah, so this week was an interesting turn of events, because on Wednesday we had the U.S. CPI number for May come out, and then the same day in the afternoon we had the U.S. Fed's latest rate decision. And in the morning, you know, CPI was a little weaker than people had anticipated, which was considered a bullish thing for financial markets. So everything took off saying, you know, oh good, inflation came down a bit more than we expected. But at the same time, you had the Fed in the afternoon not cut rates, which was generally expected, but that the comments made were more hawkish, in the sense of they were saying, you know, we want to see what happens next, we want more of a trend, and so all of a sudden the expectations for rate cuts went from, you know, 3 in 2024 in the second half to maybe 1 25 basis point cut in the late November or December of this year. So that was quite an abrupt turnaround with respect to expectations of easing. But the interesting part was that, you know, as I say, in the morning, all financial assets rallied. So we're talking about U.S. Treasuries, we're talking about, you know, Canadian government bonds, as well as stocks taking off on this euphoric idea that, you know, they're going to be easing interest rates. But in the afternoon, you have some unraveling of that, because the Fed saying, oh, well, we're concerned. And part of the concern, if you, I think, is this this fact that financial markets have rallied so much since last fall, since October of 2023, that they've essentially done a ton of easing already in financial conditions for a certain cohort, which is these sort of publicly traded companies, and in particular the very large publicly traded companies. That handful of big tech companies has really led the parade with these big jumps in their asset prices and their stock prices. They have allowed financing costs to come down for some of the publicly traded companies. And I think that the Fed Powell in particular, Chair Powell, is looking at that and thinking, you know, he doesn't want this runaway financial speculation, because it just causes more and more inflationary impulses in the system and malallocation of capital, and, you know, it's kind of a frenzy feeding on itself. So he's walking that very fine line between, you know, wanting to get the unemployment rate up, which is part and parcel of this plan of how we get inflation and consumption lower, is to get the unemployment rate up. And indeed, the U.S. Fed forecast now is for the unemployment to rise to 4.2% in 2025. It's already risen to 4, right, from a cycle low of 3.4 in 2022. Canadian unemployment, of course, has even risen more from the cycle low. But basically, once the thing is that there's never been a time that the unemployment rate has risen as much as it has from a low where we weren't either entering or already in the midst of a recession. In fact, when you've got this type of an increase, you typically have already been a few months into a recession. Now, it's never confirmed until, you know, many months later in retrospect, but the other little piece here is that once the unemployment rate starts to rise, it tends to tick up for month after month all the way through, even into the next recovery of the economy. And, you know, I think that that's, so they're walking this edge where they're saying, we think that U.S. GDP should be, say, 2% in 2025. At the same time, we think the unemployment rate is going to continue to rise, which is like a little, you know, subnote for that means that we're going to see weaker consumption. And all of that is kind of giving these mixed signals. But the other thing is that, you know, full-time employment has already been falling. And again, anytime you've seen this much of a contraction in the U.S. full-time employment rate, you've already been in a recession. That's never been not the case since at least 1970. And so all of that, the rally in stocks is really this kind of, as I've called the stock market, kind of the idiot cousin of the treasury market. The treasury market rally makes sense, right? The lows of the government bond prices was last fall, October of 23, and they have been rising since on the recognition that the inflation rate is falling, that the policy is quite tight, that real rates have never been this high in more than 23 years, and that the last time we had anything close to this level of tightness in terms of the banking system, you saw recessions in the overall economy. So again, easier financial conditions through the equity market rally for a certain cohort of large publicly traded corporations. Everybody else is having a harder time here, right? Because they do their borrowing through the banking system, not through the stock market. And so this is the, as I say, the tougher for longer message that really came out of the FOMC meeting on Wednesday was that we're not planning to cut as much or ease as quickly for everybody else in the economy who's struggling right now with higher interest rates. So it's also true that treasury yields tend to peak. So this is back to, you know, prices last October were the lowest for government bonds in the cycle, and that's when yields were the highest. And 8 months later, when you see that kind of a peak in treasury yields, 8 months later, you tend to be in recession. Well, guess what? June is 8 months since last October. So the treasury market has long been a more reliable indicator than the stock market by a long shot. So I think that, you know, this is what we expected to happen. We expected the central banks to be slower to cut this time because of their concern about inflation lingering in the system. We, you know, anticipated that the spike in mortgage costs was a problem because the basket of CPI is largely 30% to do with housing costs, and we had this big housing bubble, certainly in many cities in the U.S., but certainly in Canada. And then you have this increased mortgage borrowing rate, which is impacting the cost of carry, so it's inflating all of the shelter aspects of that CPI basket. And until they get prices to come down significantly, it's going to be really hard for the central banks to get inflation back to their 2% target. So the bond market sees that and goes, whew, this is going to be painful. They're going to keep rates tight, real rates the highest in 23 years. That's going to continue to impact households and most of the companies in the world who don't borrow through the stock market. And the other piece of that, of course, is that while, as I say, the treasury market normally rallies while we get into the rate cutting cycle, that's typical for the prices of those safer assets to rise. But the other part of it is that it's typical for stock prices to fall. And I think that's the piece that, again, most of the people, a lot of the people trading or speculating or thinking they're investing in these markets don't seem to appreciate that is the reality, that once they get into the cutting cycle, which the Bank of Canada already started, of course, this month, they lowered the base rate, as well as the ECB lowered the base rate. The Bank of England expected to do that at its next meeting. You know, so once we get into this easing, it's then that the unemployment begins to really spread, and the weakness really proliferates through the economy, and that's when companies start finally lowering their earnings expectations, and that's when the stock market realizes, oh, we've been really over-exuberant, we've paid way too much for these assets, and that's where you get the average decline is typically about a 24% loss over the couple of hundred days after the first cut. And when you go into these cycles with the extremely elevated valuations like we have today, like we had in 2001 and 2007, the average decline in the stock market takes place over much longer, like a year or more, and the average loss is more like 40%. So I think all of these are very important things for people to try and keep in mind.
We'll have more with Danielle Park right after this.
Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com.
Welcome back. We're speaking with Danielle Park. Danielle, what's your outlook for the Canadian real estate market?
Yeah, so, you know, again, back to first principles, it's typically 24 months from the start of a tightening cycle before you really see the impact of those, of the higher rates hit things like interest-sensitive sectors like housing. So we are now 27 months since they started the tightening cycle in March 2022. So we are far from, you know, everyone thinking, oh, they've hiked rates, now they're into cutting and all is well. It's just not how it works. It takes a couple of years for these things to move through. So what that means is that we have indeed seen a peak in Canadian home prices a couple of years ago, and they've been slowly coming down. The year-over-year change in from the peak of the price cycle in Canada, nationally prices are off about 14%. But I've been writing recently about, you know, Ontario and Vancouver, where most of the population in the country lives, were also the places that saw the greatest run-up in prices, right? So they're first-class cities. That's where a lot of the immigration was coming into the past couple of years, and there was this sort of belief that, you know, that prices only went up, which is not true, never been true, but that's what a lot of people believed. And then don't forget, mortgage rates were less than 2% in 2020. So during that easy money era, with all those mistaken beliefs, you had a lot of people buying up all kinds of real estate at really crazy prices, multiples of household income that were, you know, 12 times household income, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. The long-term average, which is considered the affordability norm, is more like 3 times household income. And in various periods in time, like the early 90s, because we'd had prices coming off significantly from the bubble peak in the 80s, you saw housing come down to sort of 1 to 2 times household income, which was quite affordable and quite reasonable. And indeed, that's that sort of rebooted the system. Well, today we still have, although prices have come off from the highs, they are still extraordinarily elevated relative to household income, relative to rent, so they don't make any sense on a financial calculation. So what you've got is this standoff right now between those who have properties that are trying to sell them at prices that they perceive to be market, which was in fact more like when rates were below 2%, you know, a couple of years ago, and they're still offering these things. And we've got this massive inventory, if you look around, of properties, $1-2 million in that range. These are regular kind of subdivision style homes. Yes, nice homes, but these are the same cohort of properties that increased sort of 100% in the 5 years before into the peak in 2022. So they're still way off the charts expensive. And if you look at the Bank of Canada rate and how it impacts mortgage rates, you know, of course, the bond market sets mortgage rates. So the fact that the Canadian, for example, 5-year treasury price has been increasing since last fall, that has effectively brought mortgage rates, which tend to be 5-year fixed, is a popular term, as you know, in Canada, Jim. Those mortgage rates have already come off the peak of above 6% to now in the 5% range, which again, historically, mortgages were 5% is still really quite reasonable, low, you know, moderate. From 1984 all the way to 2004, that entire 20-year period, Canadian mortgage rates were never under 6%, just as an example. They didn't start falling until under 6% until the 2004 area, and that's when, you know, central banks were cutting rates and all that. And guess what? Prices fell during that time of as mortgage rates were coming down. So it's not true that mortgage rates falling necessarily translate to rising prices. That's a misconception that people have got out of this really bizarre experience Canada's been through. But the fact is that you would have to see, like right now, the Bank of Canada's cut 25 basis points. There's an expectation they may cut another 75 before the end of this year and possibly another percent off the base rate in 2025. That would get the overnight rate down to about 3%. Well, you know, again, that's very benign and reasonably low and all that good stuff. The price of money shouldn't be free, so I'm all in favor of all this. But the fact is that a lot of the mortgages that are coming up for renewal were taken out when the, you know, 5-year treasury yield was less than 0.5%, as an example, when the overnight rate was 0 to 25 basis points. So it's not going to provide any kind of quick help to people who are looking, you know, when things come up for refinancing. And not only that, we've got a couple of trillion in commercial property mortgages set to renew by 2026 as well. So it's not just the household sector that's facing this. So I do think they're going to be cutting rates in the face of rising unemployment, in the face of problems in the housing market. I've been writing about, as I say, in the area where I live, north of Toronto, we've already seen a significant drop in asking prices. I still think they're way too high, but they've been marking down prices now for the past couple of years, and in the last month, the amount of listings has leapt again. I think a lot of people were thinking as soon as the Bank of Canada starts cutting rates, we'll get the property listed because there'll be this big boom in demand. It's not picking up, and the reason is the math still doesn't work, right? So the Globe and Mail actually did this piece, and I put the table on my blog this month, but it was basically looking at, by the numbers, how much you need to see housing come down to get it back to any kind of affordability range similar to before the pandemic. And even before the pandemic, let's not kid ourselves, Canadian housing was elevated and expensive, but it just got so much worse since then. So they were showing that you'd need to have you'd need to have a price decline of about 33% to get housing affordability back to just where it was in, say, 2019. And if we come off, you know, that's in addition to what we've seen so far. So I just think we've got a long slog here in terms of the housing market. There's a lot of people that are starting to default. You know, there was a headline this morning, we've got $1 billion in defaulted mortgages. That the percentage of mortgages that are defaulting is still quite low relative to historic norms. But because people got these big jumbo mortgages during the pandemic when they were paying these obscene prices, that's why, you know, when they default, these mortgages tend to be really big, $several hundred thousand. And so the banks are having to, of course, set aside loan loss provisions. They see this wall coming. There's a lot of people panicking and trying to sell now. And I think that that's going to continue for some time.
There's a big fuss about the capital gains tax rate going up in Canada. Is it a big concern for people who are worried about Canada's productivity?
Well, I've seen and listened and read. I've read the budget. I've read all of the various commentators. I try and listen to both sides of every argument. And I understand that people don't like to pay more tax. I get it. I understand there's a good amount of government spending, which people deem to be a waste, and they find that to be particularly painful if they're paying more tax and they think the government is wasting the funds. Allocation, as I've spoken of for some time, this obsession and policy support for housing, you know, the protecting of capital gains in housing has been something that has encouraged a bunch of people to build up a lot of their net worth, put a lot of their investment dollars into housing, which at the end of the day, Jim, is really just shelter. So when you have a home that's worth $500,000, it is actually more productive than a home that's worth $5 million. Certainly, there's a lot more negative cash flow consequences coming from a consumption unit of a house that's, you know, many millions of dollars or much more expensive, and property taxes and insurance and maintenance and utilities, everything has escalated along with the price typically. Square footage went up during the era of low interest rates. as I was talking about rates falling from 1984, people started to build and buy bigger and bigger housing as interest rates came down. So we know that that experiment with low rates has cost us plenty. And so now the issue is we've got to reinvest in so many new areas to reinvigorate the economy, to bring Canada along from this, housing gambling preoccupation to a leader in terms of innovation and manufacturing and productivity improvements. And where are we going to get that money from? So, we can't take money from people that don't have any. We can't take money from the unemployed, which are growing daily in Canada. They're not going to be paying taxes. They're going to be on the receiving end of government help. That's going to increase in the next couple of years as the economy stumbles. So we're going to have an increase in spending. We have to get revenue from somewhere, right? So this is the thing about this new idea. And yes, they have taken some provisions to say, for you individuals, first of all, the biggest one is that in Canada, our entire house, no matter how much money it's worth, is protected entirely from capital gains when you go to sell it. That is actually getting questionable in my opinion too, considering the amount of revenue we need to raise and the amount of investment that's needed in productivity in this country. So they didn't touch that one. That's considered the holy grail, right? We can't go near that because the voters have the bulk of the net worth in this country, and the bulk of their net worth is in housing. So then they said, let's go for the secondary housing or the secondary property market. So if you have a house there that you're looking to sell, it was only half taxable before. Now we're going to make it two-thirds taxable, and you get to shelter the first $250,000 of that. So that was kind of a sweetener or a placator to those that have, lower levels of net worth in these secondary properties. But for people that have own property through small corporations, they don't get that $250,000 protection. So if they go to sell an asset, they're going to be paying two-thirds of it is taxable at the marginal rate of the income of the company or the individual. So basically speaking, I think I understand why it had to happen. I understand the need to get more revenue. I do hope that the government doesn't spend it on things that aren't going to help us in the long run. I am worried about subsidies to legacy industries and companies that actually create more harm than they help. And I want us to look at all of that. But I think that ultimately, as I say, you can't get blood out of a stone. We have a huge inequality problem in terms of the haves and the have-nots, which has got worse over the last 20 years as interest rates have fallen, and they basically allowed companies to buy back their own shares, and they had all these sort of tax breaks. That's become a problem now because spending is so much more than we're bringing in. So at some point, you got to balance something, right? You've got to look at ways to get income and cut spending in ways that are going to be productive in the longer run. So all of that to say, I wasn't surprised that they brought it in. I do think that we're going to have to look at paying more tax as we go here for a while.
Danielle, thank you so much for chatting with us.
Thank you.
My guest has been Danielle Park, editor of the popular blog Juggling Dynamite and president of Venable Park Investment Council Incorporated. If you have any questions for Danielle or for any of our guests, you can send them to info@howstreet.com. Find us on X at How Street. Our YouTube channel is Talk Digital Network. We're also on Facebook. I'm Jim Goddard. Thank you for listening.
Comments made on HowStreet.com radio are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any matter whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Available online at TalkDigitalNetwork.com, HowStreet.com radio is a production of HowStreet Media Incorporated.